If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
House investigators zero in on a tweet from former President Trump in the latest hearing on the January 6th Capitol riot.
People who were on some social media platforms shared what their reactions were to that tweet, which were things like, Trump wants us to go to Washington, D.C. This is going to be a war. We need to fight for him.
Plus, why President Biden's trip to the Middle East this week is being met with criticism. And what new images from the James Webb Telescope could tell us about the history of space. It's Tuesday, July 12th. I'm Daniela Cheslow for The Wall Street Journal. This is the PM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories that move the world today. Twitter is suing Elon Musk over the billionaire's attempt to walk away from his $44 billion takeover bid. The suit filed in Delaware Chancery Court comes days after Musk moved to terminate the acquisition. He says Twitter hasn't provided the information needed to assess the prevalence of fake or spam accounts and was in breach of the merger agreement. Twitter lawyers said in a letter disclosed yesterday that Musk's intention to abandon the transaction was, quote, invalid and wrongful, and that Twitter hasn't breached any of its obligations. President Biden is heading to the Middle East for his first trip to the region as president. After a stop in Israel, Biden will be flying to Saudi Arabia at a time when the oil-rich kingdom is closer than ever to Russia. Our White House reporter, Catherine Lucey, says Biden's trip has already sparked controversy.
The president and his aides have really tried to de-emphasize the idea that they are going to ask the Saudis to pump more oil. You know, they argue that they are going to Saudi Arabia for a summit of Arab nations. They have also been very clear that the goal is not a one-on-one meeting with the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is, you know, criticized by a lot of the president's allies here in Washington. And obviously the controversy around the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, which the U.S. intelligence community concluded that the Crown Prince ordered in 2018.
We report exclusively that top immigration officials are planning to instruct detention centers that women in their custody are entitled to abortions. In a memo shared with the Wall Street Journal, the acting director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement said, despite the recent Supreme Court ruling to end the federal right to an abortion, the agency should continue to provide women in custody access to full reproductive health care. An official familiar with the memo said it will likely be sent this week. California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed a bill allowing private citizens to sue companies, including gun manufacturers, for violating the state's firearms regulations. It's one of a pair of bills passed by the Democratic-controlled legislature to use civil liability to target the gun industry. The other, which Newsom has also said he'll sign, would allow individuals to sue to enforce bans on certain types of weapons. The laws were inspired in part by a Texas law that allows private citizens to sue to enforce abortion bans. The gun industry and firearms advocates have vowed to challenge the measures, saying they violate a federal law restricting litigation against gun companies. London's Heathrow Airport says it'll cap the number of passengers departing from the international hub to 100,000 a day until September 11th, and it's asked airlines to stop selling new tickets for the summer. Our aviation reporter Ben Katz says the cap follows similar moves at other European airports as the industry grapples with a historic surge in summer travel and staffing issues.
Airlines are battling with cabin crew shortages, pilot shortages. There really is this labor squeeze kind of across the entire industry. So I think there really is this recognition between airlines and airports that, you know, there is a status quo at the moment where travel is being disrupted and passengers are not having a good time. And they really just want to try and get to a resolution that, you know, helps ease all of these strains, while at the same time not losing too much revenue.
We report exclusively that Netflix is in talks with Hollywood studios to strike a new deal, allowing Netflix to stream its content on an advertising-supported version of the platform. According to people familiar with the matter, the streaming giant is renegotiating with Warner Brothers, Universal, and Sony, among others, to guarantee that the tier with ads is as robust as the commercial-free one. Netflix has told studios that it would like to debut that platform by the fourth quarter of this year. Coming up, what was going on behind the scenes at the White House in the hours before former President Donald Trump tweeted about a protest in D.C. on January 6th? And were there direct ties between the White House and the far-right extremist groups that stormed the Capitol? We'll hear more about today's January 6th hearing after the break.
If only life had a remote control, you could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol held its seventh hearing today. This one focused on connections between former President Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election and far-right groups that were at the center of the violence that day. The hearing was led by Stephanie Murphy of Florida and Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin, both Democrats. Murphy focused on a tweet that Trump posted.
Early in the morning of December 19th, the president sent out a tweet urging his followers to travel to Washington, D.C. for January 6th. Be there. We'll be wild, the president wrote. As my colleague, Mr. Raskin, will describe in detail, this tweet served as a call to action and, in some cases, as a call to arms for many of President Trump's most loyal supporters.
Our colleague Siobhan Hughes covers Congress for The Wall Street Journal and has been following the hearings. She joins us now. Hi, Siobhan.
Hi, good to be here.
Siobhan, tell us big picture. What was the mood of today's hearing and what was the focus?
So the hearing today was really about the period after December 14th when the Electoral College had met and the election was officially over, but for this ministerial certification on January 6th. Each of these hearings has been aimed at peeling away, to some degree, a particular defense or a particular argument being erected by the Trump campaign. This time around, it's something that Liz Cheney encapsulates in her opening argument when she says, Trump cannot use as a defense willful blindness. He cannot say that he didn't know, that he wasn't warned.
So let's talk about how they did that. The hearing started out by focusing on two events, the tweet that we mentioned before and we'll return to, and a six-hour-long meeting that took place in the White House the day before. Tell us more about that.
We heard a firsthand perspective about that meeting from Pat Cipollone, who was President Trump's counsel at the time. The circumstances were that a group of people had essentially broken into the White House and finagled their way into a private meeting with President Trump. Most prominently among them, the lawyer Sidney Powell, who has advanced conspiracy theories, and Mike Flynn, who was President Trump's first national security advisor, who had promoted the idea that the election was stolen and who were intent on getting him to take what the White House lawyers viewed as very, very extreme measures to overturn the election, including trying to seize voting machines. What's important about that meeting is that Trump sided with the group that detractors call the crazies. He rejected the advice from his own White House lawyers and sided with this other group. And that's significant because that meeting is what was fresh on his mind right before he sent the tweet in the early hours of December 19th, telling people to come to Washington, D.C. on January 6th. Be there, he tweeted, we'll be wild.
Siobhan, let's talk about that tweet from Trump. How did the committee show that this message got through to Trump's followers and the effect on them?
So the committee showed a series of communications from various kinds of right-wing platforms where right-wing hosts amplified that message.
people who were on some social media platforms shared what their reactions were to that tweet, which were things like Trump wants us to go to Washington, D.C. This is going to be a war. We need to fight for him. And so you see the real-time reaction of the foot soldiers in Trump's army and the middlemen, the personalities like Alex Jones, who are functioning as the sergeants and the lieutenants urging people on.
And did you see any evidence that Trump and his inner circle were aware of the impact they were having on the extreme right?
There's not direct evidence. And one of the bars that the committee may try to show it has cleared is this notion that the intersection between the extremist groups and President Trump himself was super tight. They try to get at that in very minute ways. For example, they show that President Trump had a phone call with Steve Bannon minutes before Steve Bannon went on his War Room podcast to tell people that all hell was going to break loose on January 6th. And so there's a certain implication of these connections, but if this ever does go to a court or even in the mind of the public, there is going to be a question about whether people believe that is an airtight link between President Trump and the extremist groups themselves.
Another big moment in this hearing was talking about the night before January 6th. So January 5th, that's when Trump supporters already came to Washington. They held a rally that was so loud that witnesses said they could hear it from the Oval Office. And they said that Trump actually demanded that one of his meetings take place with the doors open so he could hear that crowd in Freedom Plaza in Washington. Did the January 5th rally give any indication of what might be coming the next day and how much Trump knew about how violent his supporters would ultimately be?
Well, it's certainly an indication of the energy levels of a segment of his crowd. And that crowd in particular was important because this was the group that was deemed so potentially dangerous or worrisome that this group is prevented from participating in the rally on the Ellipse. And so it tells you about the energy level of a particular segment of Trump supporters. And we know that Trump's supporters are the key element that is going to make the difference on January 6th.
We heard from two witnesses today, Stephen Ayers, who was charged after he took part in the January 6th attack, and Jason Van Tatenhoff, former media director of the Oath Keepers. What did they show about Trump's influence on his followers?
Their testimony personalized the experience of at least a certain segment of Trump's followers in that it showed the devastation on some of these lives. So, for example, Stephen Ayers, the person who stormed the Capitol, talked about how he had lost his job after the event, how the things that he held most dear, country and family, had now been put at risk, how he had ended up feeling misled by President Trump. And from inside the room, I can tell you there was an incredibly moving moment at the end of the hearing where, when he went to leave the hearing room, he walked in front of a whole line of Metropolitan Police Department and Capitol Police who were there witnessing the hearing, and they shook hands and they hugged. And it was a moment of reconciliation, perhaps the most profound moment of reconciliation we have seen since the January 6th attack.
What has former President Trump said about all this?
We don't have a response from him today on his social media website, but in general, he's criticized the Select Committee, said it's politically motivated, and that the witnesses are spreading falsehoods.
Siobhan, what are the next steps for this committee?
This is all a preamble to what we believe is the final hearing in this series, which is what was happening in the White House on the day of January 6th. We know that we're going to be hearing from Pat Cipollone, not in person, but more details from the closed door interview he gave to the committee. And so it's going to be what one of the committee members described as a minute-by-minute account of what was happening in the Oval Office that day. We should also note that today's hearing ended with something of a cliffhanger or a kicker, where Liz Cheney disclosed that
President Trump had called somebody who we've not yet seen in one of these hearings after the devastating Cassidy Hutchinson testimony from beforehand. And this person was so concerned by that call that the first thing they did was to call the committee. They did not respond to Donald Trump. And Liz Cheney says, we take witness tampering very seriously, and we have referred this to the Justice Department. So the legal stakes have just been raised for President Trump.
So raising the legal stakes, and more to come in the next hearing. That's Wall Street Journal congressional correspondent Siobhan Hughes. Thank you.
Always good to join you.
And finally, NASA released the first full-color images from the James Webb Space Telescope today, showcasing its ability to peer deeper into space and thus further back in time than ever before. A decade-long delay and a series of budget cuts almost derailed the $10 billion telescope. WSJ science reporter Eileen Woodward says the Webb's success extends beyond the newly released images.
The first one released on Monday by the president was this deep field look, the deepest and sharpest infrared image of the early universe we've ever had. And basically, it's this black background that's just riddled with color. And these color dots represent galaxies and stars and cosmic dust and just incredible, incredible image.
Woodward says they will inspire astronomers to ask new questions that were previously unknown.
It just multiplies the possibilities of what we're able to discover about our universe, about the birth and death of stars, about the black holes at the center of galaxies, about dark energy, about dark matter. There's no corner of astronomy that this telescope's observations are not going to touch.
And that's What's News for this Tuesday afternoon. We'll be back tomorrow morning. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Daniela Cheslow for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.